finally, a psychotherapist that focuses on helping people strive for self-awareness and thrive for self-satisfaction with their place in the world. It's a show for real people with real lives, with all the drama, trauma, and chaos that life can throw at you. Here she is, Dr. Bev.
Welcome to Emotions Are Us. Did you know that one out of two children are diagnosed with ADHD? And they're diagnosed as young as 2 years old? In the terrible twos, you're going to give someone a diagnosis of ADHD? Oh, you say, hold on, Dr. Bev, you're going too fast. Okay, I get it. I'm sorry. Let me slow down a minute and say what ADHD is. Okay, let me tell you what it is. ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, commonly known as ADHD. It is a biological disorder that causes hyperactivity, impulsiveness, and attention problems. Parents do not cause ADHD. Howbeitsoever, parents can play a key role in the treatment. Behavior therapy is an effective treatment that improves ADHD symptoms without the side effects of medication. Just drink that in. Drink that in. That there are over 6 million children diagnosed with ADHD in 2011. And that is the last time that the Academy of Pediatrics did statistics for this. My information comes from the CDC. And so you can look that up, follow it up, and then follow along with the conversation that we're having today to see how it is affecting you and others, how so many children are misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed, or not diagnosed at all. And these children, it causes grave problems for them as they grow to adulthood. I want to bring on my guest, Clarissa Bell. Welcome to Dr. Bev, Emotions Are Us on America Out Loud.
Good morning, Dr. Bev.
So looking forward to our conversation about this topic.
I am so happy you brought up the statistics. I'm seeing the same CDC said the diagnosis is increasing. It's increased 16% since 2000. Not only are millions of children being misdiagnosed with ADHD, but millions are being over-medicated and medicated for ADHD unnecessarily.
Unnecessarily. Now, I want you to talk to me for a minute and talk to my audience and break it down. How can you tell the difference? You know, if children are being diagnosed as early as 2 years old. Now, for me, I have a child. He's an adult now, but his two-year-old period was not fun. You know, back then, and that's way back then, they called it the terrible twos, you know, because kids
right.
are trying to find their way and their boundaries and this and that. And so it was, in my family, it was a behavioral issue. So you needed some structure. You needed to be communicated to differently. You know, you needed some boundaries set. You needed to be reinforced. We call that home training. That's what we called it back then. Tell me, what has happened in the time since just my son has grown up? And he's only 40.
Well, right. Well, the studies that you're referring to show 1 in 5 boys had diagnosed ADHD, with two-thirds being treated with stimulant medication. And it's about energy. High-energy kids are disruptive to the structured environments of preschool. And we didn't have the preschool setup that back then that we do now, even.
Tell me, diagnosing a two-year-old, how difficult can that be?
Exactly. What my feeling is about that is that preschool is more prevalent now than it was in the 60s and 70s. the more children are showing up in preschool, the more is demanded of them in terms of structure and being still and staying on task and focusing forward. And the children that are not ready to do that are being labeled ADHD.
So they're what we call, this word that I do not like, the bad kids. They get labeled.
And they internalize those negative messages. It impacts their self-concept. And if they are the unfortunate ones to be put on remedial medication like Adderall or Ritalin, it can suppress their growth. It may interfere with their natural social and creative growth as well.
I hear what you say, what you're saying, that there's a huge rise in this diagnosis at the preschool level when the child is really discovering the world and it's told it's to be sit down, don't move, follow this structure, go by this, and this is what all the other kids are doing. And we've got 3 or 4 or 5 kids that are not doing it, so we're going to punish them. And you say the implications of this are really, it's grave to their self-esteem.
Plus, it leads to overcorrection and unrealistic expectations of that age group.
Oh, it just makes me want to cry, because 1 out of 2 children, if you go in your daycare centers, and now we have, what is the program that the children go to before kindergarten?
Head Start,
Head Start. And so that's a program where, you know, that structure comes in at such an early age. And you're right, it suppresses the creativity, the uniqueness of each child, because every child doesn't learn the same. Every child is not the same. And every child does not have ADHD. Are we over-diagnosing and over-medicating children?
I believe we are. We're not taking significant factors into account in assessing normal children. We're not looking at, okay, so in preschool, 2 children might be 2 or 3, but 1 might have just turned 2 or 3. Same with elementary school and kindergarten and first and second grade. They might be the same age, but they might not be in the same level of growth. 1 might have just turned 7, might have been 7 almost a year now, mm-hmm. and their behaviors are going to be different, and yet they're treated like they're behind or like they're not keeping up. And that impacts the way they feel about themselves and the way they feel about learning.
Talk to me about that. How does it affect the way they feel? And then how does it affect academics? Because I see it affecting academics long term.
Well, it can cause them to associate negative emotions with the school environment and make them apprehensive and anxious and uncomfortable in the school environment, which is going to impair their ability to pay attention and to record information that's being given to them.
And what about children who at age 2 are living in dysfunctional families and dysfunctional environments? How does ADHD affect them?
Again, that is more about misdiagnosing, being too quick to label, missing diagnoses that might be in play, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, post-traumatic stress, acute stress disorder, even adjustment disorder. If a child is starting school who has just moved and changed all his friends, and or if a parent has been deployed or has moved out of the home, things are going to be causing some disruption in that child's life, and they're going to be labeled ADHD because they're not paying attention and they're not showing interest and they're being disruptive in the structured environment without further information to show, you know, more empathy toward that child.
Yes, and that is just it's something that we see, that the teachers have like this talking point. They have this form that they fill out and they give to the parent to fill out. And it's a simple questionnaire that even I could fit into it if I wanted to, because sometimes I am hyperactive. I am a risk taker, so I'm impulsive at times. And I do have attention problems. You know, there are times when I'm really focused on a subject, my show, a person, that, you know, I'm not thinking about, you know, what time is dinner and what I'm going to get for dinner. I'm focused on simply that. Or if something is happening internally with me where I'm going through some kind of crisis, you know, my mind might be on that and not totally on the subject at hand.
And the behavior lists are then given to the physicians and parents, and parents panic. They don't want to be neglectful. If their child has a disorder, they want to treat it. They want to get treatment right away. They don't want their child to be singled out in the classroom. They don't want the child to be stigmatized. So they quickly take their child to the physician. There are more expensive tests that could have ruled out ADHD, but most parents can't afford them. The neurological testing, the deep evaluations given by psychiatrists and psychologists are extremely expensive. And so they rely on their physician to see the data on the list, agree that it's ADHD, and prescribe medication, which can be detrimental to the growth of the child.
I always say that back when I first started, one of my clinicals was at a community agency where we dealt with young children up to the age of 16, I believe it was. And the largest group of those children were diagnosed with ADHD and given the medicine Ritalin. And I later did a research many, many years later and with some of my colleagues. And most of those kids that started out on Ritalin early on turned to other forms of drugs at a much early age, until most of them are now in our substance abuse centers and being treated.
I'm not surprised. Or we teach them to be drug dependent, right?
Say what?
We teach them to be drug dependent at that early age.
Isn't that something? Take a pill and it'll be all right. But yet, what are those pills actually prescribed for when it comes to their academics? It's prescribed so that the children can do what?
Learn and pay attention and be good citizens.
They're medicated so that they can follow the crowd. They're not a disruption. That's mainly what it is.
You'll see by middle school, they've learned their friends would like some of that medication. It becomes a nice source of income for some of these kids.
Stop! Clarissa Bell telling all about it. See, that's why we have Emotions Are Us. You get the real truth. Now you know. It is true. It becomes a source of income. Isn't that something?
And popularity, because the kid with the good gets a friend. You know, everybody wants to hang out with that one.
Of course.
So, it's just, we're telling them that they don't have the power to manage themselves in a situation to guarantee their success and achievement, that they have to rely on a drug to get there. And it's unfortunate. It's very sad, actually.
Yes, and the CDC says that, you know what, the first line of treatment for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in young children, behavioral health, should be tried first before we move to any kind of medication.
Okay, when I'm presented with a child that a parent is saying has ADHD, my first response is behavioral with the parent. suggesting environmental controls within the home where the atmosphere is calm, there isn't any hostility or yelling or any cause for the child to be hypervigilant or nervous or uncomfortable in the home environment. So I work with the parents to alter their behaviors and their interactions with the child and the atmosphere of the home, and then begin working with the behavior of the child.
And that's called parental training. Mm-hmm. How many parents get parental training before they have a child? Do we even know?
Not a lot, I would guess.
And not a lot, I would guess. If there's anyone out there that's doing a study on this, please help us out here. Because parental training is paramount, especially for those children ages 2 to 5. That if we can work with the parent to teach them how to parent that particular child, then that child is going to grow exponentially in
exactly
how far it can go in school, how far it can believe in itself and oneself and know that, you know what, I'm having some difficulties over here, but there's always a solution and here's how I can go about it. You know, there are many children.
That's why, well, I agree. And that's why in my practice, we do a lot of premarital counseling. We encourage it, and we have a huge segment of that being about parenting and being prepared for parenting, examining how they were parented, what aspects of the way their parents parented them they want to repeat in their parenting, and what they don't, and how to avoid that, and how to turn that around so that they are better parents, so that they can know how to respond to challenges with their children without resorting to verbal and physical violence.
Yes, yes. Have we seen a rise in physical violence towards young children, babies even, expecting babies to behave a certain way? And surely by 2 years old, they're diagnosed because they're diagnosed with ADHD. It's very, very sad. It's very sad. I also, because it's a misdiagnosis. Like you said, some parental training, some behavioral intervention prior to medication should be enforced first. Put that in
exactly
place first.
Now, in terms of misdiagnosis, the children that are diagnosed ADHD may also have another diagnosis. They may be dual diagnosed, or they may have another diagnosis that looks like ADHD. And one of the most prevalent ones that we overlook the most is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
Yes.
When a child has been exposed during the pregnancy to alcohol, they exhibit many of the same symptoms of an ADHD child and are often diagnosed ADHD. In fact, 94% of the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder children that were diagnosed with FASD were also diagnosed ADHD. But we miss that. I think we're diagnosing a lot of children ADHD that are actually fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
I would believe that, and that we could also, we have to rule out some other diagnoses that have similar symptoms to ADHD, you know.
Exactly.
And that's
such as I get past the normal children, the temporary adjustment disorder children, and move into the post-traumatic stress disorder children. Mm. Where they have been exposed to high levels of stress or actual verbal and physical abuse, or they have been injured, or they have witnessed this injury, and it impacts their behavior the same. And they have that same attention problem, memory problem, behavioral problem, low self-esteem, and they're diagnosed ADHD and put on Ritalin.
I say Ritalin was a new form of crack. It was just It just went straight there. It's like, no, each time if a parent comes into my office and they say their child is on Ritalin, I'm just like, no. Let's, can we do something different? Because it's really scary to me.
You sound
especially
like me.
I've been in this business for so long and seeing my young kids that I treated grow up, and many of them have grown up just taking the medicine, not having any kind of psychotherapy, and definitely not behavioral health therapy, and not having any of that. And it's sad, to see one of them where they can't even get into the military. Did you know that?
Exactly. If they have a history of a diagnosis of ADHD, they're disqualified.
Isn't that something? Because they could even be a gifted child would display these same kinds of behaviors. And, look at Albert Einstein.
Right. And people are not schooled. Counselors, doctors, teachers, parents are not educated to know the difference between a gifted child and an ADHD child. If that gifted child is not paying attention because they're bored out of their mind in the classroom, putting that poor child on Ritalin, it's not right. Now, I got to say, because I wanted to say this earlier, I must have worked at that same agency you worked in. I worked in a national counseling agency that lined children up at the door and outside and around the building for that 3 to 5 minute consultation with a psychiatrist as he sat there filling out prescriptions for Ritalin. It was one after the other. That was the only exposure that psychiatrist had to those children. And all of the counselors, young, fresh out of school, thinking they're doing what's right because that's what they're being told to do, not knowing to differentiate diagnoses or to look for any environmental factors that could be contributing to the behavior of the child at the time, and bringing these children in to line up in front of the door of the psychiatrist for their prescriptions. So they all got them and they all walked out proud and feeling like they got what they needed. And many of them had no such symptoms. I had one child tell me that he was told to report the symptoms.
Isn't it? See, now that's where you and I just go hand in hand. I have seen it. I've just witnessed it with my own eyes. Children prepared, they get coached to come into the office, especially on the day that the psychiatrist is there. They're going to make that. If they don't make it, they're supposed to come once a week, or minimum twice a week. But they'll make that one day, that 1 month appointment and make the psychiatrist to get that medication. And they have already been coached. When you go in Dr. Bev's office, tear that thing down. But they didn't
know
that.
Now, why do you think they're doing that? Why do you think they're being coached?
Well, I have several reasons, and I'm just going to go straight to the first one. Number one, money. Ever since the DSM-3 put out that that was a diagnosis that was a clinical disorder, that you could get a disability check for that child.
We have the little one growing up thinking they're disabled.
That they're disabled. How
and they're handicapped.
Tragic.
And they're not as good as the other kids. Right.
Thank you. And then we find 16-year-olds in the 7th grade. Now, that's where I'm going with that. And then, like you said, by then, that 16-year-old who's in 7th grade realizes that this Ritalin, I can get $10 a pop for each one of these pills.
Exactly. 25 in some circles.
Oh, 25.
Yep.
See? And you know what? I find that 25 mark here where I service the community, I find that in my gifted community. My gifted community, these children are so bored in school. Yes, they can sleep through the class. They can play. They can act out. But when the test comes around, they ace it. Got an
right,
A.
Exactly.
You know, they know the system so well that they know that they only have to have so many points by the end of the grading period. And boom, you know, at the end of the grading period, they just make sure they have just enough to get, you know, a C or, you know, sometimes a B. My high functioning kids will always make sure that they get A's. And then they'll use the reason, it's only because of my medication. That's why I have to keep taking my medication. And so my, you know, parents who come from affluency, they want to keep that child, and especially in the home, you know, behaving a certain kind of way in front of company and all of the concerts they go to or whatever they're involved in the community. They want these children to behave a certain way so they continue to give them something that just subdues them, that just brings them down.
They need to understand to what extent those medications can impair their cognitive performance. It's a stimulant. It can cause appetite suppression, insomnia, irritability, anxiety, which they could go back to the doctor and get more meds for that, sadness, nightmares, melancholia. I mean, they're setting their child up for failure in so many other ways. Socially.
Economically.
Creativity. Yeah. And they're not doing their child any favors.
They're not doing
it. And who's going to stop it? I mean, communication. We need to be able to communicate and educate the parents, the teachers, the counselors, the primary care physicians and family doctors and pediatricians to not accept these lists, behavior checklists, as evidence of a disorder.
Yes, because
they need to require a lot more information. And unfortunately, even when a parent will pay the $800 or plus to go get a psychological test done, a lot of those results rely on parent reporting, teacher reporting, child reporting, and they've all read Dr. Google.
Yes.
They've all been to Dr. Google or read the behavior checklist.
So they know exactly what to check.
So they all know what
Google to check. Is my best friend, okay?
Exactly.
WebMD, okay? If I go there for information, of course parents are going to go there for information. They know exactly what to check.
Exactly. Exactly. And so even those tests are not as valid as they appear to be, as they're supposed to be, because it relies on reporting. And much of that reporting, especially by the parents, is not comprehensive. They're not telling it all. They're not saying dad comes home drunk and screams and yells at everybody at night and wakes everybody up out of a deep sleep and makes them all feel unsafe and nervous and scared. And then they have to get up at 6 a.m. and get their clothes and get on the bus and go to school and act like they have a normal life.
That is so true.
That's not reported in these tests. It's not reported that mom and dad are fighting and that dad slams out the door and doesn't come home for 3 days and mom's crying in her room with the door shut and won't get up. And they're not telling the whole picture.
And you know what? None of that is asked on that form.
Nothing.
No
nothing
environmental
about.
Factors. No, nothing about the home. Nothing about what is currently going on in the home right now. The environmental controls at home, at school. It's just the expectations are unreasonable when we don't acknowledge what is happening in that child's life. What is the ground that we say as we stay in Gestalt? What is the ground that child is walking on when it leaves school? One child sticks out in my mind greatly, and his behavioral issues would start in the morning in the breakfast line. Mm-hmm. Now, what we didn't know was this child hadn't eaten since lunchtime yesterday.
Exactly.
So, of course, he's fighting to be the first one in line to get breakfast because he's hungry. Mm-hmm. And by lunchtime, you know, he's had some medication, he's calmed down a little bit, but he wants everybody's food. So that gets him in trouble. And so again, he is labeled, and that label hasn't had...
consequenced, probably. Because
major consequence.
Made to feel bad. Yeah.
Major consequence. And now, you know, at school, they have, they can even call the police and have that child Baker acted because it's so out of control. Well, I don't know about you, but, you know, if I'm only getting, you know, those two meals a day, which is supposed to be, is government adequate for right then, but then I don't have anything else to eat. And on the weekends, you know, we get to eat chips and junks and we don't get like sit down to dinner and have a meal. You know, I know why you don't like vegetables, Johnny, because you never served vegetables before. So that, you know, when I look at that, that child was so, you know, at the time, you know, overdiagnosed with ADHD, you know, as it...
And there are other factors that occur even in the most appropriate family home environments, such as birth order.
Oh, let's talk about
you
it.
You could have...
Let's talk about it.
Right, you could have 2 7-year-olds in the same class. One is the oldest in their family. One is the baby. How's that baby going to act among his peers?
Talk about
he's
it.
Gonna be,
talk about it, Clarissa Bell. Tell him.
He's going to be playful and maybe, you know, depending on help from others and being, you know, a little more rambunctious. And, mm-hmm. and he's going to be the one that is called out as being immature and ADHD, hyperactive and inattentive and hard to control. But they're not looking at his environment. If a counselor came in and could see he was the baby in his family and see how he feels among his peers as being smaller than and less capable, then the counselor could help him to see that that's not the case, that he's equal to everyone and he can be just as mature as all of them. But it just takes a little bit of intervention to turn him around and get him to feel that he is equal to his peers and to take cues from them as how he's going to behave in the classroom.
That is so true, how he's going to behave in that classroom. If we had counselors to intervene, to take the reporting from both the parent and the teacher, but then talk with that child and do what we call a biopsychosocial. Let's get some background. So what do you do when you go home? You know, my biopsychosocial is the questions are asked, or the therapist is taught, trained to ask these questions just as, you know, a natural course of conversation in therapy, you know, like, so what do you do when you get home, you know? How is it on the weekends? What do you guys do? Do you go out and go to the movies, or, you know, what do you do? You know, I worked at an autistic ESE school for a year and a half, and one young girl was diagnosed as ADHD. She was well over medicated because her behavior was like off the chart, and me not being a, you know, having gotten a degree in teaching, but my degree in counseling, I was seeing symptomologies that suggested that we needed to rule out some other things. And so I talked with the teacher about it, and, you know, they were like, no, that's what it is, and that's it. And one day I got to talk with the parents, and the parents were newly married. The mother had a significantly difficult childhood and upbringing that was very narcissistic from her mother. The young man had been in the war, and he had post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm pretty sure we could have diagnosed the mother bipolar by the way that she treated her child. But here's the one thing that none of the teachers knew, but it stuck with me. Why does this child, when she leaves here on Friday, she comes back on Monday with the same clothes on, and most often the same pull-up that she had on, which we sent her home with on Friday.
Oh, no.
I started paying attention to that. I started paying attention to when it came to food, she would just eat with her, like an animal, like with her hands, just, you know, go at it. I paid attention to that. And then I noticed that when people, especially really tall men, would get next to her, she would become very hypervigilant. I noticed that she caused such a great disruption in the classroom, talking out loud, talking as if she was talking to other people and that were not in the room. She would go into bouts of depression and then crying. And so I finally convinced the parents to please, here's an agency that will do a biopsychosocial on this child, and let's find out what's really happening. The mother sort of bucked it because she was satisfied with the medications that the child was getting because it would just knock the child out. Well, what we didn't know was on the weekends, when she got off that bus on Friday, she was led to a closet that was long enough for her to sleep in. It had a pallet and a pillow, and that's where she stayed the entire weekend. When she got off the school bus from school every day, that's where she stayed. This is the truth. This is where she stayed. And when that, I was so glad I sent it to one of my colleagues who I knew how to do rule outs. She was on her stuff. Her supervisor was great for her in teaching her how to look past what you see into what is the unseen, what is the secrets, what's not talked about. And
good for her, yes.
We found out that this child was getting medication for something she didn't even have. Yes, she was autistic, but you know what? She was schizophrenic with psychosis. Who wouldn't be with a treatment like that? And when she began to receive the right medication, when her parents were made to go to parenting classes, do you know that child became the sweetest, most brilliant angel I wanted to be around? I loved when she would run to me and get just a full hug. She'd be so happy to see us in the mornings because we would give her a bath. We would go and get new clothes for her, make her feel like something, because children can be cruel. Even if they're autistic, they can be cruel. They will bully other
absolutely.
Children. And so she knew that before we got her properly diagnosed, she knew that once we realized what was going on in the home, which of course, the parents, are they going to put that on the ADHD form?
The thing, they're not going to put their circumstances. No, they're going to cite all her symptoms and not look for the cause. And that's the primary problem that we have with diagnosing these kids. Everybody's looking at the outward behavior. Nobody's asking what's going on in that child's life.
Yes.
What's going on behind those closed doors?
Yes.
The kids will tell you. If you can build that rapport with them, like I do with my telling wheel, you can get kids to tell you what's going on.
I want you to talk about that, Clarissa Bell, your telling wheel. When I was reading your book, that just blew me away because I don't have a telling wheel, but I now have yours. But of
yes,
course,
you do.
I didn't know that that's what I was doing with the children with this game I play with them. I didn't know that's what I was doing. So I was so happy to see that in your book, and it gets me excited. Please tell our audience, what is your telling wheel about?
My telling wheel is where I'll sit down with a child with a piece of paper and some colored pencil, and I'll make a heart in the middle of the paper, and I'll put the child's name in the middle of that heart. They love that. Then I start to ask them questions. Who was in your house when you left for school this morning? And they'll tell me. And I'll say, who was in your house last night? Are those all the people that visit at your house? Are there more people? Well, give me their names. And so then I draw a line from the heart outside the circle and put their names at the end of each line. Mm-hmm. And then I start to ask questions about these people. So do any of these people get angry? And the child will tell me who gets angry. What is this one like when they're angry? Who made your dinner last night? Oh, you didn't have any dinner? Mm. How about this morning? Who made your breakfast this morning? Oh, didn't have any breakfast? It works like that.
Yeah.
They start telling me everything. And it helps me to get a better picture of why they're acting the way they are.
Yes.
Whether they're withdrawn or disruptive. And that's another thing that I have seen is that boys seem to get the diagnoses quicker than girls.
Yes.
Because for the most part, boys are more active and more rambunctious and more disruptive, and the girls are more withdrawn and more a little more oppositional and moody. So they're not as disruptive, so they don't get the diagnoses quite as much as boys.
And I find that with most of the boys, their anger is really a symptom of their depression. And because they're taught to fight and, you know, hit each other and, you know, tussle, you know, oh, they're just tussling, oh, yeah. You know, then oh, yeah. Then that is, you know, they're not just tussling. They're acting out. That aggression is really depression in disguise. And you are so correct when it comes to the girls that they're last to get, you know, the diagnosis. It's, you know, they come, I think, when it's, they become withdrawn and they don't want to talk and, you know, they're not doing their schoolwork. They're not following, you know, straight in the line, you know, going to the cafeteria, you know, then it becomes an issue for the teacher who's trying to, you know, centralize the class. And that's when that child, that girl gets noticed.
Well, also they can develop some bullying behaviors, taunting and teasing and expressing their anger that laterally that way toward their peers. They'll tend to do that more than boys.
Oh, you're talking about the mean girls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
mean girls. Rather than
being physically aggressive, they'll be verbally aggressive toward their peers. Yeah.
Yes, be very abusive towards their peers. And it's so interesting to me that how many girls want to be in the mean girl crowd. You know, they want to be in the crowd that's looked up to, especially in my when I go to, you know, my larger schools where I have, you know, gifted, I have all ranges of kids. There's that group of girls who, you know, they're wearing the latest outfits. They know the, you know, the latest songs. You know, they know all this. They've got all this slang like, yeah, and uh-huh, and no, she's a thought. And I went, a thought? What is that? She said, oh, Dr. Bev, you don't know? I'm like, no. Okay. That's that H-O, you know what, over there. And I went, really? Is that what you just called that girl? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You just said that to her? Oh, and then, you know, there's only certain people that can be led into, you know, that upper crowd of echelons, which is the crowd that's getting into the most trouble. You know, they're having these pill parties, like you said. If Ritalin can go for 25 a pop, you know, they've got anxiety medicine. They got depression medicine. They got something to help them go to sleep. They got this, that, and the other. You know, mom and dad is hardly around. They're working so many hours. You know, the kids come over to their house.
I was a counselor in a school in South Florida where Prozac was going for 25 a hit.
Oh, man. Get it now. Because, you know, yeah, now I believe you. Because,
yeah,
you know,
now this was, excuse me, this was in middle school.
Check that out. By middle
school.
This was
11 and 12 year olds, yes.
And you're wondering why by the time they reach adolescence, 13, 14 years old, why they're having sex, they're being impulsive with their actions, they're drinking, they're hanging with the mean girls who've got even meaner.
And they learn how to be dealers. But don't worry, we got prisons for that. Don't get me started on that subject.
Okay, yeah, that's right. But yeah, that's right. I forgot to say that, you know, that these kids are pharmaceutical salespersons without the license. They're not psychiatrists who have a license. So you're right, Clarissa Bell. Holla out. Say
so
what?
Sorry.
You know, they are pharmaceutical salesmen without a license. And then we wonder why they move, why they would move from, you know, the prescription drugs, because they've been such, they've been well trained. I mean, they got the numbers for it, they got the head for it, they know, you know, how much money they can make. And then, you know, but what is school to me now? I already got a career. They just don't know that that career will end them, land them either dead or in prison.
But what I discovered was it was boys, 14 to 21, many of them in there for drug dealing and drug-related crimes. Once they learned how precious they were, once they heard for the first time in their lives that they were precious and that they were better than that, better than they ever knew they were, they started to see themselves in good citizenship roles in their community. They were excited. They were thrilled to know that there was more to life than what they had seen and what they have lived prior to coming into corrections. They were eager to change their behavior to fit society and to get out there and to have a good life and to have a good family for themselves and to live a good life. It was so heartwarming and inspiring to see them go through those changes.
I know.
So it's not impossible to turn them around. They just need to know they're worth it.
Yes, and that not only are they worthy of it, that if they have the skills to be a pharmaceutical salesperson without a license, do you know how they can expand that into your own business, your own life, where you don't have to look behind your back? This isn't a career. You can have a legal career. You can own your own business. You're good at what you do. You can flip this into something even better. And I know that doesn't happen with every child, because those children then have to go back to the economic and environmental factors from which they came. But I have seen, like you, that many, once they grasp that the behavioral side, and they have therapists and professionals who and nurture them, give them information, solid information, like, this isn't the only part of the world, that little town you came from. There's a whole vast world out there.
Well, and the way that I put that, Dr. Bev, first of all, I don't let them tell me that's where they came from. I tell them they didn't come from their parents. They came through their parents from something far more abundant, with all the possibilities they could ever want.
Yes.
And that they can tap into that energy and that intelligence and that abundance, and they can make their life anything they want to make it.
You are
and
so true.
And they would just look at me in awe, like they had never realized that they have those infinite possibilities. And once they recognize that, they start to reach for it. And it's exciting to watch them do that.
It's so exciting. One of the things that I do in my parenting class, and I also do it in my groups that I have for juveniles, and that is I use the example of birth. You know, when a mother is giving birth, and that birth is finally concluded with all its pain and its glory, and that mother is given the baby in her arms for the first time. No mother looks at that child that just came out of her, this life, and say, oh, I want you to grow up to be a pharmaceutical salesperson without a license. I want you to grow up and go to jail. I want you to grow up and be the worst mother you can. No, that is not what you're told. In those first few minutes, you are hugged. Exactly. You are loved. You are nurtured. You are gifted. And they want the best of everything for you. That's what parents, that's what you really got. And that's what you came in here with. Now, in between then, we've gotten, you know, way off with this, you know, being diagnosed at age 2 to 5. Come on, with ADHD? No. And then when you go on to the statistics about 3 and 4 children in between the ages of 2 and 5 receive ADHD medicine. Only half or fewer than receive any form of psychological services. Help me,
or
Holly.
Intervention, exactly. And even those older should not be put on medication so quickly. People need to get together and team up. Teachers, parents, physicians, counselors, form a team and move in a direction that is going to save this child from being misdiagnosed and mistreated with the wrong medications. And
let's talk about that. Let's talk about the importance of a team approach. Parent, right. Teacher, team approach with the physician and the counselor. Let's give our audience some information, some tips, some skills by which they can leave us and say, okay, I know I have help now. Here's the way I should go about it. Even if my child is already diagnosed with ADHD, perhaps I can look into this further. Let's give them the importance of a team approach from your point of view.
Right. Well, community-based mental health services often have a home intervention program component to the services they offer. That home intervention program allows a counselor to meet with the child at the school, get an assessment of what the issues are at school, follow that child home, introduce herself to the family, get a background on what's actually going on within the child's home that are contributing to the behaviors the teacher is reporting at the school.
Mm-hmm.
Then the counselor can work with the parent and siblings, the teacher, and the child in moving that child forward. Without that information in all those different arenas, there's no way to make a comprehensive diagnosis that is true.
There you go. There you have it, audience. That's the team approach. Whether your child is now diagnosed with ADHD, and again, I will tell you what that means, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, commonly known as ADHD.
We need to support the funding for further research and studying the brain and the functions of the brain and how, when it is ADHD or PTSD, we can actually help the child physically and medically so that the child can get better. So we need to fund further research and the functions of those parts of the brain that affect those disorders. And we need to fund these counseling programs in all of our communities. So many times as I worked as a home intervention therapist, every year we sweat out whether or not the contract was going to be dropped and there wasn't going to be funding to continue the program because of the lack of funding. We need to know that these programs are up and running and supported by our communities because they are important to all of us, not just the families and children we serve, but to the entire community.
Yes, because each child, each family makes up the community. And
exactly.
As you said, the funding for this, first of all, I want to say that the last statistics that we have are for 2011. and that's by the CDC. We do need, and they even tell us, they need more money for mental health research in terms of this one particular aspect right here, because it would save them so much money in the long term. I told you before that it cost a total of, in 2000, $31.6 billion to treat ADHD.
Right, and who's making that money? There's the interference with the lobbying that we need to get these funds for the community. So we need to be looking at that also.
We definitely do, to get... to get this, not only this community, I would like to get America, this is America Out Loud, I would like America to have an intervention program funded such as what they have in England and the UK. I would love to see us doing some of those, you know.
Tell me about that program. What are you talking about?
They have programs in the UK that teach what, you know, we used to call home training, but they put parenting training, teacher training. They put in England, the Royal British Family, the young kids have come out and say, hey, we are going to, but this is not going to be once a month, one time per year, rather, that we have mental health month. They're going to have mental health year. They've expanded and put money and research into all areas, not only just ADHD, but in domestic abuse, in many, many areas, in men, in the gay community. All of this is a wraparound, is what they're doing in England, and in the UK has far surpassed anybody. The UK has full wraparound services, even for that child that has autism, to be correctly diagnosed, not misdiagnosed. Behavioral interventions are paramount. Next to that is the parental intervention. They realize that parents are overworked, overrun, stressed out, in difficult, just in so many different kind of difficulties, that they have this wraparound service. They have this community service, you know, at each of their schools and in the community. So they have reduced the number of the crimes. They've reduced the prison population. They've reduced the substance abuse population. And I'm sure that's what we're going to find in England during this next year, is there's going to be a process of growth in that, in all of these areas. But in particular, starting with children ages 2 to 5, you know. Wow. The princess is really onto that because she has children. These are the ages of her children. So she's really into looking at this, and this overdiagnosis of ADHD, which is a biological disorder that causes hyperactivity, impulsiveness, attention problems. She's looking at it in her own children and saying, wait a minute, my children are ADHD? No. We have to have some decorum here. We have to have some rules in the family. We have to have some structure. The way we communicate to our kids is how our kids are going to behave. In many of these families, like you said, the child becomes special because, you know, okay, it's got this label, ADHD. So, well, you want it to act out so it can continue to, you know, get the medication, be it because you receive, you know, a check from the government for the child, or you don't receive a check. It really doesn't matter. The effects are still the same, sometimes even more gross when you have a family of 5 kids and all 5 of your kids got ADHD. Really? And you getting a check for each one of them? Yes, Dr. Bev is going to tell it. This is emotion or us. America Out Loud Network. That's the reality of it. And we look at that, and it is for the detriment of each and every child that we put this stamp, this label on before we have tried these other interventions.
You said it, Dr. Bev. You are brilliant. That is exactly what it is.
I love you for saying I'm brilliant, Dilding. It's just all of these ideas that I think are not brilliant, but simply common sense. That if we use what you've called the team approach, the importance of it, parent training, teacher training. Well, if we get to the parent, we get to the teacher, we have a counselor coming in there that's a real therapist licensed that is that therapist is passionate about what they do. They're not going to just look at the outward signs. They're going to dig deeper. They're going to use your, what is the wheel you call it?
The telling wheel.
The telling wheel that you have in your book. They'll use those kinds of schematics to get what they really need out of the teacher, out of the children. And then they can really help the psychiatrist diagnose and give further the diagnosis, do some rule outs, and give the correct medication if medication is needed. Oftentimes,
exactly.
It's not
very
needed.
Actually needed.
Yes.
Or also that, you know, if there's another diagnosis, if the quote ADHD behavior unquote is masking, the child could be treated for that. If it's being gifted or being or PTSD or FASD or even an adjustment disorder, that symptoms are masking.
Tell me what FASD. We don't often hear that.
That's the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
There you go. That's what she's been talking about. Now, yeah. We commonly call it FASD. And then we also have the children who are born with drugs in their system. We have these illegal drugs, mescaline, and all the things that the parents are getting into now. And the children are born with meth in their system, and opiates, and barbiturates, and so they're starting off on that. And we have to rule out those things. Those symptoms first, to get to the ground of getting to this, again, importance of a team approach, a community approach. That is what I'd like to see happen in America. America, this is Dr. Bev, Emotions Are Us. I am here with Clarissa Christabel. And please find her book on Amazon. Enjoy our show page about her and this show. If you have a need in your community, feel free to contact Dr. Bev here at Emotions Are Us, America Out Loud. We will be giving you some sites that you can go to get further information, such as the CDC, such as SAMHSA. Please check out all the books you can about troubled kids and how we can help them become the citizens that we want them to be in our America. We're a melting pot. We began as a community. We began with family. Let's go back to family.